Okay. So, first of all, thank you to Dr. Nordman for the beautiful location, for sponsoring. This year is going to be in memory of my grandmother, Sarah Bat Nehemia, who is in, we're in the middle of the Shloshim right now. So, Mirat Hashem, it should be an aliyah for her neshama. We're going to talk about Pesach. And as always, we're trying to get some general big ideas so that when we come into the Chag, things can inspire us. We could say, oh, yes, that connects to this idea, that connects to that idea. So, like we did on Rosh Hashanah, we want to try to look into the name of the Yom Tov and see what that can help us to understand about what the Yom Tov is all about. So we know that Pesach has three names, right? Chag HaPesach, Chag HaMatzot, Chag HaAviv. But generally we talk about it, we talk about Pesach. Right? Here comes Pesach, we're going to come and sit, you know. Pesach is coming. So the main name of it, the main concept of it, seems to be this concept of Pesach. So what is Pesach? Where does the name Pesach come from? We'll just start with that. Where does the name Pesach come from?
Comes from passing over.
We know that at some point Hashem was Pesach. Hashem passed over the houses of the Jewish people in order to get to the houses of the Egyptians. But there is also Pesach, which is, that's also the name of the Korban. Right? The sacrifice that we eat on Pesach is also called the Pesach. Which is another interesting question. Why is the sacrifice itself also called the Pesach? So, if we look at the word Pesach, we want to understand what does it mean. It's actually a machloket, it's a disagreement between Rashi and the Targum Onkelos. Now, anytime we're talking about the Korban, the sacrifice itself, Targum Onkelos just calls it Pischa. It's called the Pesach. That's what it's called. But when we're talking about the action, when Hashem actually passes over the houses of the Jewish people, there he calls it Chayis. God was Chas. He had mercy. So Rashi actually brings down this idea of Chemla, of having mercy on the Jewish people, that the word Pesach means to have mercy. It means that Hashem had mercy on the Jewish homes. But Rashi says, that doesn't seem to me to be the definition of the word Pesach. Instead, Rashi says that Pesach is Poseach. It's from the word, Rashi over there says psiot, but also we'll see in a second that Rashi calls it kfitza v'dilug. Rashi has these two descriptive words, kfitza and dilug, for what it means to do Pesach. Right? It's some sort of a jumping, a leaping. We have to understand maybe if there's a difference between, right, jumping and skipping, kfitza and dilug. So that's how Rashi understands it. The whole holiday then, essentially, right, the whole Yom Tov, we're calling it Pesach because it's a commemoration of the fact that there was this moment where Hashem skipped over the houses of the Jewish people. Which means if we want to understand what the Yom Tov is all about, we have to understand why that is seemingly the essential name that we give the Yom Tov. Okay, so there's a Rashi in Chumash, which has given me sleepless night for many years. But we'll read it, and we'll try to cobble together some sort of understanding of what Rashi's saying. Well, the verse is like this, it's a pasuk in Shmos. We are in chapter 12, verse 11. V'kacha tochlu oso. This is the way you should eat the Pesach offering. This is what we're talking about right now. Masnechem chagurim. Your loins should be girded. Nalechem beraglechem. Your shoes should be on your feet. That's a good place to put them. Umakelchem beyedchem. You should have your staffs in your hand. V'achaltem moso bechipazon. And you eat the Pesach in chipazon, which Rashi translates as Behala. It's very harried state that you're supposed to eat it in. Pesach hu, it is a Pesach laHashem. It is a Pesach to Hashem. So now we have to understand what it means for a sacrifice to be a Pesach to Hashem. In what way is this sacrifice a Pesach to Hashem? Right? Rashi said Pesach, that was the action of Hashem going over the houses. Either it's jumping or it's mercy. But what does it mean when we now apply that title to this korban, to this offering? What are we supposed to understand from that? Here's the Rashi. Pesach hu l'Hashem, a korban hu karui Pesach. The name of this korban is Pesach. Al shem adilug v'hapsicha. On the name of the skipping and the jumping, shekodesh baruch hu medaleg bate Yisrael. Hashem skips over the houses of the Jews, mibein bate mitzrim, from in between the Egyptians, v'kofetz mimitzri lemitzri, and he jumps from Egyptian to Egyptian, v'Yisrael emtzai nimlat, and the Jews are left in the middle. So Rashi's building this sort of two-sided construct. Hashem skips over the Jewish homes.
It's a checkerboard.
And then he says he jumps from Mitzri to Mitzri, and the Jew is left in between. Seems to be two actions happening over here. Vatem asu kol avodosav l'shem shemayim. And you should do all of its service, all of its avoda, l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. There's a whole tumult over here, whether there is a Dover Acher and Rashi, whether this is a second answer, a continuation of the first answer. We're not going to get into it. We're going to read it as one answer. How do you do it, l'shem shemayim? Derech dilug v'kfitza. When you do this Pesach offering, you should do it with dilug and kfitza, with skipping over and jumping too. Zecher l'shmo shekrui Pesach, as a remembrance to its name, which it's called a Pesach, right? And Rashi also translates one more time this word Pesach. So that's the Rashi. And the question is, what does it mean exactly to do the Pesach offering in Kfitza and Dilug? Practically. We could probably say a lot of nice Musar ideas, a lot of nice Hasidish ideas, but practically, step up, you're bringing the offering, what does it mean to do it with Kfitza and Dilug? That's the question. Now there's a very nice Revolbe over on this Rashi. It's an Ali Shor Krach base. He has a little piece there on Pesach, and it's at the very end of the piece on Pesach. Revolbe says the following idea. There are a lot of big ideas about Pesach, and we'll try to jump from one to the other and skip over the unimportant ones. Revolbe says as follows. Revolbe says like this. He says, you know, if you think about it, Pesach night is the night of Geula. It's the night of redemption. That means that Hashem himself, right? Ani v'lo malach, me and not a messenger. Hashem himself is coming to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt. Says Revolbe, how could a person ever merit to be at such a level? That level is so high of having a direct interaction with Hashem. How do you possibly merit such a thing? In what way can a Jew merit such a thing? And of course, he connects it to the fact that on Leil HaSeder, on the night of the actual Seder, we're supposed to see ourselves. Every single person is supposed to see himself as though he's leaving Egypt. How can we possibly merit an interaction with the Shekhinah, with God's divine presence, knowing that we're nowhere near such a state in our day-to-day lives? So Revolbe brings the famous Derech Hashem, right? The Ramchal in the Way of God speaks about the fact that as the Chagim come around, the Moadim, these destinations in time come around, there's a certain light, there's a certain spiritual flow that comes into the world every time that cycle, or really that spiral, loops. So the point, the light that comes into the world on Pesach, he says, is kvitza. He says it's the ability to leap. He says the way that Hashem brought this leaping into the world on that night, he jumped over the houses of the Jewish people, so too we have the ability to leap on Pesach. We have the ability to jump, especially on that night. What does that mean? It means that even though normally, during the year, a person has to be extremely careful not to try to grab too much, to jump too high. If I'm not mistaken, Rav Volva brings there the Gemara and Sukkah and Daf Memtes Amud Beis on page 49, folio B, where over there it says, it talks about God's chesed, and it talks about chesed and mishpat, that God's chesed and mishpat, his kindness and his judgment fills the world. Right? So the Gemara wants to know, why specifically are we talking about those things, that God's kindness, God's judgment fills the world? The Gemara says, you could have thought that kol sherotze likfotz kofetz. Anybody who wants to do chesed, he wants to give tzedakah, he could just leap and just do it. He says, no, brings a verse that mayakar chasdecha Hashem, how precious is God's chesed. Chesed is something which is very precious and rare in the world. A person can't say, I want to go do chesed now, and be able to go out and properly do chesed. Hashem has to actually line up situations in order for you to have a person or a situation in which you can do chesed. If that situation doesn't exist, then you can't do chesed, and actually chesed is something that has to be pursued. You have to chase it, you have to find it. So this is the example that generally there's a process to things in life. God has to line things up, and when they're aligned, if you're prepared, you move forward in steps. But you can't just leap. You can't just say, I want to reach a certain spiritual level and jump. Rav Volba says the exception is Pesach. Pesach is the one day a year, because God brought this spiritual flow into the world of jumping, where you can just leap and grab higher than you can normally reach. And on Pesach, you can achieve those levels that you cannot normally achieve. That is how he understands Rashi over here, that you do the avoda of the Pesach with kvitza and dilug, that you can reach and grab higher spiritual heights than normal. Now, the Sifsei Chachamim over here disagrees with Rav Volba, or at least he's bringing it at a different angle, because if you read Rav Volba, it sounds like Rav Volba is talking about the service of the whole night of Pesach, including the Seder night and sitting down. Whereas Rashi seemed to imply, if you looked at Rashi, it said Avotav, right? Kol Avodotav, all of its service, sounds like he's talking about the sacrifice itself, has to be done with Kvitza of a Dilug. So the Sifsei Chachamim and also the Levusha Ora, they both understand Rashi means that when you do the Korban Pesach, you have to do it b'chipazon. That's what Rashi is trying to explain to us in the verse. Why does the verse say we have to do it b'chipazon? We have to do it with this alacrity, with this expedience, because that's how Hashem brought us out, right, with Kvitz and Dilug. And so too, when we do the service of the Pesach, we have to do it the same way as well, with alacrity and expedience. Yeah? Do you have a question, Rabbi Stryker? Yeah, move ahead.
From my point of view, yeah, I'm anxious to see where it's going.
Okay. Okay. So what do we see?
We see
from this connection over here, from the Sifsei Chachamim, we see the connection over here from the Levusha Ora, that the idea of Pesach is the idea of chipazon. As Rashi, right? What's chipazon? The verse says, right? You're ready to go. You can go at any moment. You're ready to run out the door, right? That seems to be the idea of Pesach, that you're fully prepared for anything to happen.
And that's what we understand about the first Pesach.
That's how they had to eat it, right? That's what we said. This is how you have to eat it. So they understand that Rashi is explaining why the eating has to be done that way. Because it's a Pesach LaHashem. The name of it is explaining to you why it has to be done in this way. Okay, now we come to Seder night. And we're trying to understand what Pesach is all about. We're trying to understand what the offering of the Pesach is all about. We know that it's Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're supposed to be talking about the exodus from Egypt, leaving Egypt. That's the theme for the night. So when you come to Seder night, and you want to give everybody at the table the introduction to what Pesach is all about, where should you start? What's the first thing we should talk about? Is I want to introduce the theme for the night. I'm going to pick one topic. You should know this is going to be the central theme. Everyone pay attention. That's what it's going to be all about, right? The Baal Haggadah took an awful lot of time to structure the Haggadah, right? I mean, it's really not just his work. It's the work of centuries, which was compiled into a set format to maximize the experience of the mitzvah of the night, of speaking about, right, Sipur. It's not just Dibur, Amira. It's a Sipur. It's a whole story of the experience of leaving Egypt. How would you introduce it? What should be the first thing we talk about? What's the main theme? What do we do?
Holach Mo'ami, I would say.
That's what you would say?
I would say.
I don't know if that's what you would say, but that is what the Baal Haggadah would say. Much to our surprise, I think, if most of us were writing the Haggadah, which fortunately we didn't, we would have started with talking about slavery, or Geula, or the redemption, or we would have talked about the Pesach Aver. It's called Pesach. The whole holiday is called Pesach. Instead, the very first thing we talk about, the second we have the ability to say something, to talk about anything, right? We do the basic things that we have to do. We say Kiddush because we have to do Kiddush. We have Urchartz and Karpas because we need to get to the Karpas, because that's going to not mess up halachically, raise any questions of brachos when we get to the maror. We did all the things we have to do. Now the first thing we can talk about it, what do? We hoist our matzahs into the air, gently. We crack one, and we say, halach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction, and we say, possibly one of the most difficult, nonsensical passages of the Haggadah. What do we say? This is the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate in Egypt. Right? Well, first of all, we're saying this is the matzah our forefathers ate in Egypt. Now, it could be in the back of your, you know, parents' house, there's some Manischewitz matzah which maybe did come from the first Pesach in Egypt. But, first of all, what matzah did our forefathers eat in Egypt? What are we talking about? This is the bread of affliction, which sounds like it's during the affliction, right? So when during the affliction were they eating matzah? When were they eating matzah?
The morning they left.
The morning they left, they were eating matzah.
No, throughout their slavery.
Throughout their slavery. There is an interesting Abu Dirham like that.
Yeah.
And there's a Shlah that want to say, the Abu Dharam is very interesting, that there was a captive from India, and they understood that they would feed them matzahs. The captives used to feed them matzahs because they lasted for a very long time, and there was a little food and it could satisfy people, and right, and there's a shlah that says like that also. There's no source other than Abu Dharam in that shlah, I mean, as far as I know, that say, there's no medrash, there's no gemara. What?
They'd be leaving with its own affliction. So I've heard it said that for the last bit in Mitzrayim, they had it pretty easy. Like, they didn't have any slavery or whatever. Like,
it was hard for them to leave Mitzrayim.
Yeah, I'm saying maybe leaving Mitzrayim in and of itself was an affliction because they had it so easy towards the end.
So when were they eating? We want to know, when were they eating the matzah in Mitzrayim?
They were eating while they were leaving.
From the time they left.
When they were leaving. So the night that they left.
Right.
And the next morning,
they were
eating matzah.
They had no leavened bread. Right.
The reference is always that it baked on their shoulders in the sun.
Yeah, so that's good. Yeah. So then you're coming right from the pasuk, right? Yeah. We're coming right from the verse. The verse says that we ate matzahs because there was no time for the bread to leaven.
But then they didn't eat that at the Seder.
But then they did eat that at the Seder.
No.
Yeah, they did. Because if you look at this very verse that we're talking about with the Korban Pesach, and you go just a little bit further down, it tells you that you have to eat this very offering that you're eating, or is it a little bit before? you have to eat it together with matzah and maror. Meaning they were already had a commandment that Leil HaSeder, the first Leil HaSeder in Egypt, they were to eat Pesach, matzah, and maror.
Correct.
Okay? So the night they left, they were eating matzah. And the morning they left, they were eating matzah. And this brings up the point, right, that you were raising, which is, well then if that's when we're eating matzah, then that's we're leaving Egypt. Why are we calling it the bread of affliction? This is like the bread of freedom. Right? This is like what we're eating when we're going out. So we're calling it the bread of affliction, but saying this is what they ate when they were in Egypt, which seemingly was the last day, the last, you know, less than 24 hours that they were in Egypt. And then we go on and we say, anybody who's hungry, come and eat. Okay, people ask, it's a little bit strange, right? The commentaries ask, a bit strange. Now you're inviting people to eat, like, you know, like you should have invited them before. It's a little bit last minute. Okay, if you're hungry, come and eat. Good, if you're hungry, you can eat the matzah, I guess. You have other stuff there too. I don't know why specifically they want you to eat matzah. The next one, though, says anybody who needs, yeseh v'yifsach, come and Pesach. So we have here in the Katz family Haggadah translation, whoever's in need, let him come and join in the Pesach. Another difficult question, because we all know that the offering of the Korban Pesach has to be done in a chabura, and it has to have menuim. You have to be
registered
onto that korban. You can't show up at the door after it was shechted and roasted and say, you know, I'll have some also. And also, how does the matzah solve that problem? We have four problems in this passage. If you're hungry, come eat. Matzah can solve that. Great. If you need, come Pesach. Matzah can't solve that problem. This year we're here. Next year in Eretz Yisrael. What does that have to do with matzah? This year we're slaves. Next year we're free men. How is matzah going to solve any of those problems? If you're hungry, come eat. I understand. Matzah solves that problem. But the next, you can eat matzah if you're hungry.
But isn't the theme of Pesach slavery and liberation, not just simply liberation?
The theme of Pesach is certainly slavery and liberation, but why am I saying halach ma'anya? Why is matzah the mascot for the theme of the night?
It's the bread of affliction. They were afflicted when they were in Egypt, and now they're being reminded, even though you're on your way out, that you had an affliction.
But and how does the matzah represent that?
Because it's just unleavened bread. It's just water and flour.
I mean, that's true, but are we going back to what Rabbi Ostreicher was saying about that maybe they actually ate it while they were being afflicted? Or are we saying, no, the simple understanding is they did not eat it while they were being afflicted. They ate it now when they were commanded to. We don't see anywhere that they ate matzahs otherwise.
But we associate freedom and luxury with actually leavening, with challah. You know, that's a food of a wealthy man.
Also hummus, food. You know. Eating hummus is also very pleasant.
Obviously the wealthier you are, the nicer your bread's going to be, the cleaner it's going to be, right, the more refined it's going to be, the more time you're going to have to leaven it, right, to really let it rise, and all of these things, the more luxury you have in your life. At the same token, we do see that this is what Hashem wanted them to eat when they were actually experiencing Geula. As a matter of fact, we'll raise the stakes, we'll add in the Gemara and Kedusha, and there are actually two times when the Jewish people ate matzah. It's interesting, Gemara and Kedusha is trying to figure out how to make the calculation. It says that we ate man for 40 years, but it's not true because there were months missing. So the Gemara says, well, we ate matzah for a week when we left, and we ate matzah when we came into the land of Israel. The first entrance, the conquest of the land of Israel, starts on Pesach.
Yeah.
And those two matzahs, it said, had the taste of the man. Tasted like manna. That's the Gemara and Kedusha. So now we're raising the stakes even more. It's like, not only is this what we eat when we leave Egypt, this is what when we eat when we go into the land of Israel. And it tastes like man. It tastes like angel food. Right? Angel food cakes. The first angel food cakes.
But are we eating man because we're going to Eretz Israel? Are we eating matzah because we're going to Eretz Yisrael, or are we eating matzah because it's Pesach?
Or was it just a coincidence that we went into Eretz Yisrael on Pesach and ate the matzahs?
Could it be?
Obviously, that was part of the plan, right? The stars were aligned that we should go in on Pesach, and the Gemara finds tremendous significance in the fact that we were eating matzah at that time.
Is it from Derisa that we only eat it 8 days?
Seven.
For 7 days. Is it from Derisa that...
Yeah, it says in the verse says you should eat... Well, it says you're not allowed to eat chametz for 7 days. The mitzvah from the Torah is to eat it on the first day. You're right. The other 6 days, there's no mitzvah chiyuvis. There's no obligation to eat it. Right? The Gaon, the Vilna Gaon famously understands that it is a mitzvah kiyumis, that if you do eat it, you get a mitzvah, right? Which doesn't happen if we were to eat matzah tonight, but there's no obligation. Okay, so there's this... Yeah.
That monk could taste like pretty much whatever you wanted.
That's a... Good, that's a whole different other discussion. What did it? What did these matzahs taste like? Is it possible... Look, I'm not against the possibility that those matzahs actually tasted like whatever a person wanted them
yeah,
to taste like.
Case, it would be its own thing. It doesn't taste like man, it just also tastes like whatever you want.
Which is the taste of man.
I'm saying, it's similar to man, but how can you say it's the same case when it, just, it has similar properties?
So either because either we could say that it's the simple taste of man that Rashi brings, right? Our famous, the famous coriander cakes fried in honey. Right, as that's how it's translated at least. Or we could say that because they're both tapping into some sort of a spiritual place that allowed us to taste whatever we wanted to taste, we'll have both of those possibilities. Okay, so these are the different questions. So now, the question I want to ask now is, okay, so now... We assume the first time they were eating matzah, the simple understanding, they were eating it the night of Pesach, right? While they were waiting for the Egyptians to give them permission to go out. So now, we're going to take ourselves back, we're going to do some pre-Pesach work. We're in that atmosphere. We're in Mitzrayim. We got all the bags packed. The kids are ready to go. We know that any moment, Paro's knocking on the door, saying, "You're all clear. You know, hasta la vista, see you later, head on out." What is the mood, what is the ambiance in the Jewish homes on the first Leila Seder while they sit and wait for Geula?
I would be excited.
Excited. Huh?
I'd imagine very tense.
Yeah, there'd be fear too, though.
Yeah.
Fear.
Because it's the kind of thing where you've been waiting for this for so long, and now you're being told it'll happen tomorrow, and you're just waiting like, oh, what if it doesn't happen? What if this goes on?
So let me ask you a question, right? Let me ask you a fear question. What happens if God promises, "I'm going to take you out on this night"?
He might have promised that he'll take them out, but he didn't say necessarily how. So it could be if they do something wrong or whatever, it could not. It could be in a way that's not, you know, good or whatever. Like, you don't always have to worry that, oh, you know, who knows what might happen.
Well, wasn't there millions of Jews that died with the plagues anyways?
In the plague of darkness.
Yeah.
According to
that, they could be afraid that maybe something else might happen as they're being brought out or something.
According to that one opinion, 4/5 of the Jews disappeared during the plague of darkness.
And also...
They didn't want to leave Egypt, and they didn't.
They got there. Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. Yeah.
They likely had the memory. Wasn't there? There was a group of Yidden who left early, and they all died.
There's a whole medrash about There's a whole medrash about Jews who tried to leave Mitzrayim too early.
So there should have been some fear with some people.
But in fact,
yeah,
it's clear that they need some word from Paro in this process.
Yes.
Right.
No, but more so, than that, Hashem said they weren't to leave at night because Hashem didn't want them to appear like thieves. Running out at night, wait till daylight, and then they would leave, and they would walk out. Not
okay.
Like they're running out, walk out as if...
Good, we have to be careful how many midrashim we're going to mix in over here, but yes. Okay, so there's a amazing Rabbeinu Yonah in the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Dad Amud Beis, which is talking about the blessing of Hashkivenu that we say at night. Now we know that the halacha goes that we always are trying to connect Geula and tefillah, right? So we always want Gal Yisrael, the blessing of Geula, of redemption, to connect right to the beginning of Shmona Esrei, just like we do in the morning, right? Gal Yisrael, stand up, three steps, daven. We're connecting Geula to tefillah. It's an amazing thing. Geula, the Chazal speak about it, that it's like knocking on Hashem's door, right? And Hashem comes, you want to be there. You don't want to leave. Whenever we speak about Geula, that's like knocking on Hashem's door. Okay, good. So the Rabbeinu Yonah says the following thing about Hashkivenu. The Gemara asks the question, how then can we stick the Hashkivenu bracha in at night after Gal Yisrael? We said Gal Yisrael, and now we have this whole Hashkivenu, Hashem, you save us from this, you save us from that, you save us from this. What's it doing here?
I'm so sorry.
That must be the wife.
You have to be careful in northern Israel setting off. All right. So how can we put the Hashkivenu blessing in between Gal Yisrael and Shmona Esrei when we're supposed to connect the two ideas? How can we put something in between? So the Gemara answers that Hashkivenu is actually there because of something called Geula Arichta. Because there was a long Geula. There's some sort of process of Geula, of redemption, that starts earlier, it's more drawn out, and therefore it's not an interruption. We could talk about Geula, we could have Geula Arichta, we could have a lengthier Geula process, and then we can say Shmona Esrei, and it's not a contradiction. Rabbeinu Yonah wants to explain the idea of Geula Arichta, and he says as follows. Rabbeinu Yonah is brilliantly moving off of a previous Gemara, which talks about a situation with David HaMelech and with Yaakov. Famously, that Yaakov was afraid to confront Esav, even though Hashem had already told him he was going to protect him. And the Gemara says he was scared that tzaddikim always have a fear, Shema Yigro Machet, maybe I did some sort of a transgression, and now I no longer have the merit. Says Rabbeinu Yonah that the Jewish people, the night of the Exodus, sat in Egypt petrified. They were petrified, Shema Yigro Machet, maybe someone, one person, we know it only takes one achan to mess it up for everybody. One person, right? Maybe somebody is going to do a transgression. Maybe we no longer have the merit. We know that Hashem promised, but maybe we're no longer going to have the merit to go out of Egypt. So he says the entire night they stayed up in prayer and supplication. And so therefore the Hashkivenu blessing, Chazal actually were metakene, they actually put it in the prayer as a parallel to that night of being in Mitzrayim. So now we see that there's actually this very interesting duality of matzah happening in Mitzrayim. Because on the night, it really is lechem oni. Right? This is really a time of tremendous fear and affliction. In the morning, the Jewish people go out b'yad ramah. They have upraised hands, right? They're celebrating and they're eating matzah. So somehow matzah, and not Pesach, right? Because we have to make a clear distinction over here. The Pesach offering, the maror, all those things they ate at night. In the morning, they only ate matzah, right? There was no Pesach in the morning. It was matzah that they ate in the morning. And it was matzah that they ate when they passed into the land of Israel in the days of Yoshua, in the time of Joshua. So we see matzah has this interesting duality to it. Okay, so now we're going to go to the famous question that we started to speak about, which is, why do we eat matzah on Pesach? Right, Rabbi Ostreicher brought the verse, because there was no time for the matzah to leaven. And of course, the commentaries asked the famous question, wait a second, Hashem commands us very clearly. Before that even happens, on Rosh Chodesh, Hashem already commands us that we're going to eat matzah then. So, what's the real answer? If Hashem commands us, then why did the verse say it's to commemorate the fact that the dough didn't have time to leaven. It's because Hashem commanded us. That's why we eat it.
It's very tough because they actually made matzah the day before.
The ones for the night, it does seem that they actually threw it on their shoulders as they were leaving.
That's what it seems.
Yeah.
But it's quite peculiar because...
But they had a chabura, they got together, they made matzahs a few days before, they had, you know, they all got together, right.
They
sold...
used up all that matzah, and the next morning, they have dough, but no matzah.
Yeah.
Right? It is strange.
Okay, but we're trying to solve the contradiction over here. On the one hand, Hashem commands us, on the other hand, it says, because there was no time for the matzah to rise. Steps in the Maharal, a very famous Gvuros Hashem. He says it in a bunch of places in the Gvuros. He speaks about matzah in a few different ways. So first of all, he says something amazing about this idea of lechem oni. On the one hand, we call it lechem oni. On the other hand, he says this should be lechem geula. Right? This is freedom bread. Why are we calling it affliction bread? So he says, oni, you have to realize... that there's a quality, there's a character of being an ani, which is actually the true definition of what it means to be free. There's a misunderstanding. If you're a slave, obviously you're not free. That's obvious. Someone else is in control of you. But what happens if you're wealthy? Right? You would think the opposite would be to be a wealthy man. If you're a wealthy man, are you free? No. Right? You got to talk to Uncle Sam. Right? You are mishuabad, you have a enslavement to your physical property. You own a house, you have properties, right? You now have to take care of them. You can't just turn around and leave them all behind. So it says the only free man is a person who owns nothing, is the ani, a person who has no possessions. Now we're not going to get into that whole conversation. But ultimately, that's what you see, walking into the desert, right, with Hashem, was saying, I have nothing. Because we ate man for 40 years.
Well, except for all the gold and stuff.
Which went to the Mishkan.
Yeah.
Right? Who was it there for? Why did we have it? Right? A person can have possessions and be an ani when you realize everything comes from Hashem. But, fine. So says the Maharal, a true free man is the ani. Thank you so much. And the matzah encapsulates this idea more than anything. So let's talk about some of the ideas of matzah that he says are truly remarkable. He says that unlike maror, for example, why do we eat bitter herbs? Because, right, because of the bitterness of Mitzrayim. Why bitterness? Why we have this phrase, this idea, and right, we see it starts in Chazal speak about it. It's even in the standard, you know, American lexicon. Who knows, in Schwizerdeutsch, do you also say bitterness to talk about something that was...
Bitterkeit,
of course. Always sounds so nice in Schwizerdeutsch, though. Bitterness, why do we talk about it? Why not spiciness? Why not sourness? Why specifically do we talk about things being bitter? So the Maharal says that bitterness has a hitpa'alut to it. When a person eats something bitter, he can't help but have a negative reaction. You lose control. Right? It's interesting culturally that in a lot of cultures, people like spicy foods, sour foods. It's less bitter foods. There's something about the way we react to bitter tastes, right, which is a stronger reaction than everything else. He says, that's the taste of true shiabud. You don't have control, right? You're mitpa'el. You're reacting. You're reactionary to something. You're not in control. So what would the opposite of that be? What would freedom taste like?
Sweet?
Nope.
Sour.
You're also mitpa'el from sweetness.
Yeah.
Right? You're also mitpa'el from sourness. Freedom says the maral is matzah. Doesn't have like a strong taste. You're not mitpel at all. It's pashut. It's totally simple. He says the whole idea of matzah is simplicity. It's being pashut. There's nothing extra mixed in. You're as simple as you can be. There's no extra ingredients, right? We don't even add salt to matzah, right? It's just water and flour. But the most important thing that the Maharal wants to teach us is that It doesn't even have time. The amazing thing about matzah is that unlike bread, there's no process to creating a matzah. You mix it, you bake it, you're done. Whereas bread, you mix it, you step back, you let nature take over. Nature runs its course, and now you have this thing you put in the oven, you have bread. He says the freedom of matzah is it's not even bound by time. It's not bound by process.
What about the 18 minutes?
The maximum, you only have up to 18 minutes.
There, right?
No, if you go over 18 minutes, it's not matzah anymore.
No, but it's a time constraint.
Yeah. Again, what are we trying to say?
He said there's no bound on time. He said there's a constraint on time here too, because the 18 minutes.
If you go over 18 minutes, it's not matzah anymore,
matzah,
though.
Right. So there's a constraint there. There's not, it does have a time bound.
Again, if you can make matzah in 5 seconds, then that's matzah. Right? If you allow time to come into matzah, it's no longer matzah.
But you have time in the 18 minutes.
It is minimum, so
no, the time says that processing is not happening. Beyond the 18 minutes, then you're into a world of processing.
I agree. I mean, I'm just agreeing.
I'm just saying
there's a time constraint. There's a time constraint. It's not like there was no time.
But on the maximum, not on the minimum.
So we're just let's just wait. Hold on. I just want to try to simplify.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Hold on. Let's just try to make it as simple as possible. Matzah is still food that we make. It's not mun. You don't wake up in the morning and there it is. And so in the human rubric, that's as much as not time as possible for something which is considered lechem, right? And without going into the whole conversation of what a lechem and all that, right? We also call the offerings we put on the mizbeach lechem, lechem toda, right? Those are lechem, but it's also called lechem for the mizbeach. So it's food that doesn't have time in it. And says the Maharal, if you're going to teach a Jew about spirituality, the most important thing he has to know about spirituality is there's no process. Right? Everything else in life, you want to accomplish certain things. Nature has a built-in process. There are cycles in everything in nature. You can't cut the cycles short. Just doesn't work. If you open an egg before the chick is ready to come out, it won't survive. Right? Any cycle that we cut short doesn't work. Nature has built-in cycles that need to happen. In spirituality, right, the second you get close to Hashem, process goes out the window.
It is the process.
What do you mean?
Close to Hashem is the process of spirituality.
We have something called Kvitzas HaDerech, right? Since we're talking about kvitza, this is all about kvitza, jumping. There's a process. If I want to go to point A to point B, I have to walk a certain distance. But when it comes to ruchnius, right? If I go with Hashem, there's no distance between point A and point B. There's no process. It's here. Point B is right next to me.
Isn't that the whole famous gemara? That is the process. The process is opening it enough, you know, for a little needle, and then obviously Hashem will make it big enough for an elephant to walk through. But that is the process. You have to put out your hand in order for Hashem to grab it.
Okay, good. So now...
I'm not arguing. I'm just
no, you're not arguing at all.
Process, would start it. You're right, there is a way to skip part of the process. You don't have to go from point A to point B and walk 100 miles, but you got to start walking in order to get to the...
But if a person only knows nature, he only knows the natural process, right? Then he understands that in order to get to point B, I have to walk a certain distance. Right? When I bring a Kodesh Baruch Hu into the picture, there's no distance between point A and point B. That's the whole idea. It's all of a sudden everything becomes a kvitza, right? When we talk about malachim, right? The malachim go straight to accomplish whatever they need to accomplish, right? There's an interesting gemara there also in Brachos about the speeds of different malachim, and some malachim seemingly are faster than others at certain times also. But it's this idea that Malachim have kvitza. There's a very nice Yaris Dvash for Bionis and Eibeshitz, just so you can have something to think about next time you're doing Kadosh, 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 and you're jumping over there. He says that the reason we jump is because that's how malachim move. Malachim do everything in kfitza. What's kfitza? Just like Rashi told us, that when Hashem came through Mitzrayim, kiviyachol, whatever that means for Hashem to come through Mitzrayim, there's a process. There's topography. There's Jewish homes and there's Egyptian homes. But for Hashem, there were all the Egyptian homes were together and all the Jewish homes were separate. There was a kfitza, right? He went from Mitzri to Mitzri as though the Jewish people didn't exist at all in that process. So we see that the process of spirituality, when you bring Hashem into the picture, there's no, the whole concept of process as we know it in the natural world goes out the window.
Tom,
what about the markings on the houses?
Simplicity.
What about the markings on the houses?
They say it wasn't like Jews didn't exist, but they marked the houses to show that this is where a Jew is.
Yeah, who was that for?
I don't know, you tell me.
Rashi says it was for us.
And it was inside.
It was inside the houses.
The markings were inside the house, not on the
house? The markings on the inside were on the inside of the house for us.
Not on the outside of
not the on the outside of the houses.
Just to make a decision on which side you stood.
Well, I think it's all it's all connected to this idea of what was the process of that night. What was it all about? Which Rabbeinu Yonah, right, building off that idea, they were steeped in prayer and tshuva the whole night. And obviously the two bloods, the blood of the Mila and the blood of the Korban Pesach on the door, right, that's another discussion, understanding what each one of those bloods represented. The only two positive commandments that have a punishment of kares, right, if they're not carried out, obviously there's an interesting parallel between those two. Okay, so that is the idea of matzah. The idea of matzah is basically the idea of kvitza. That's what's coming out from us from this Maharal.
It's also the idea of tam, of simplicity.
Oh, tav mem, tam.
Yeah.
Yes, of being simple.
Yeah.
Yes, of being pashut.
Indivisible and simple.
Yes, all that's all true. Correct. Okay, so now, what are we coming out with? Why is matzah the mascot for the Seder night more than anything else? Because matzah represents halach ma'anya. If you're hungry, eat. If you want, have a Pesach. If you're a slave, if we're here, you can be an Eretz Yisrael. If you're a slave, you can go free. This idea that at any moment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can come and everything changes. You thought there was a certain process, right? How could I accomplish great things, right? I haven't done this yet. I haven't gone here yet. I haven't, right, been through this yet. Matzah says, no, forget it. When Hashem comes into the picture, when he decides, it happens. Forget process. That's what Matzah is telling you, right? If you're hungry now, we have to understand what hunger we're talking about exactly. In a moment, you could be eating. Right now, you have a desire. It's very interesting. It doesn't say you don't have a Korban Pesach. It doesn't say you're hungry. If you have a desire, you could have Pesach right now. You could have a jump. You could leap right now.
Doesn't matzah also symbolize simplicity?
Yes. Matzah symbolizes simplicity. The Maharal brings a nice example that when Chazal want to talk about a totally unprocessed piece of leather, they call it matzah. That's the word that Chazal used for just a plain slab of something. Matzah. Absolutely. But here on Leil HaSeder, why it's the mascot of the night is because it represents the potential for everything to change in an instant, totally bypassing the whole concept of time and process. All of that goes out the window when we're talking about Leil HaSeder and we're talking about Pesach. Okay. So now, I want to connect this idea with a different idea, which is the Jews were right to be scared, right? Because maybe someone's gonna do a chet. You just need one achan, one micha, one dasam and aviram to come along, and they can ruin it for everybody, and then what? And then there's no geula? Right? How could it be? We know that the geula needed to happen here and now. So, we know that Sreifas Chametz, right? We have a mitzvah of Tashbisu, of burning all the Chametz. Right? And Chazal tell us that the Chametz represents, what's the Sorsha Be'isa? The Yetzer Hara. Right? The evil inclination. Chametz is the evil inclination. So what we see is that on Pesach, we actually have an opportunity to burn the Yetzer Hara. We're actually destroying the Yetzer Hara. And there's a well-known shlah that everybody speaks about when he talks about Bedikas Chametz, that the body is an extension, the house is an extension of the body, and as we're searching through all the parts of our house, searching for Chametz, we're showing Hashem that we have a deep desire to get the Yetzer Hara out of all the nooks and crannies of ourselves and destroy it. We want to burn it. We don't want it anymore. So we have this very interesting thing that on the one hand, Chametz represents the Yetzer Hara. On the other hand, Matzah represents Malachim, the actions of Malachim. That we go to point A to B with no interruptions. Everything's totally connected for us on a spiritual level. So how is it that Chametz represents the Yetzer Hara? So if you go all the way back to Bereshis, to the beginning, in the beginning, there was a void. We see, and it's Rashi brings it, that the one thing that happened in Gan Eden, which is remarkably different to life after the expulsion, was that the concept of process barely existed. Cain and Hevel were born in Gan Eden, when? In an instant. There was no process of pregnancy, there was no process of birth and raising children. And what's interesting is that in the klalos, in the curses that come to Adam and Chava, it's historically interesting because it says over there, Be'etzev Tildi Banim, and through, how would we translate? Etzev,
pain,
hardship. We'll just use pain for now. You should birth with pain. It was actually for a long time, many church-run countries withheld medication, painkillers from women during birth, because that was the curse, right? Chava had to suffer the curse. Now, what's interesting is that the Gemara Ksuba says that Nashim Tzidkaniyos don't have Tzarleda. Righteous women don't have pain during childbirth. And if that's the curse, how could it be that righteous women don't have that pain? Whereas if it's a physical change that happened, how do they get a get-out-of-jail-free card? So Rav Hirsch says, points out, that this word etzev does not mean physical pain. He brings proof all over Tanakh that the word etzev refers to a psychological or emotional
fear.
Pain. You want to call it fear? Maybe. Anxiety. So the question is, what changed between Gan Eden and the expulsion that now there was a psychological pain that occurred? What changed? Process. When you bring process into the world, when you add time into everything, in Gan Eden, you planted something, you got fruits right away. You wanted a man and a woman came together, the children were instantaneous. You saw the results of your actions right away. If every time you did a mitzvah, the reward was there right in front of you right away, I mean, we would all be tzaddikim, right? It would be really hard not to be a tzaddik.
Particularly if the punishment was there as well.
If the punishment was there as well. Depends which generation you came from. if the results were there right away, right? If the pre came, right? That was the whole idea that the eitz pri, osa pri, the taste of the fruit and the taste of the tree were the same. Mm-hmm. The action and the result were right next to each other. There was no process was removed. The second process comes into the world, what happens? Fear. right? Psychological pain. You get yush. You start to give up hope. You become hopeless. You start to wonder, is this really going to happen? Right? Basically, the Yetzer Hara and time work in a partnership. You could even say they're the same thing. Right? Process is where the Yetzer Hara comes in. So Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted to stop the Jewish people from the possibility of Shema Yigra Machet. What does he have to do?
Eliminate process.
You got to get rid of process. You got to get rid of Yetzer Hara. You're all going to burn your Yetzer Hara. You're going to eat angel food. Right? And you're going to be able to accomplish things you could never accomplish because all that process stuff isn't going to get in your way. That's the whole idea of the matzah on Leila Seder. That's why the matzah is the mascot for the night, because we're going back to Rav Volba now. Rav Volba says this is a night where you have the ability to grab higher than you've ever been able to grab. Now you could ask yourself, okay, what's the practical avoda? What are we supposed to do then, right? Rashi tells us it's v'chipazon. On Pesach, you have to be ready to leap. There were, as Raphael pointed out, 4/5 of the Jews didn't leave Egypt. Why not? Because they didn't want to. Right? It's interesting. Rav Volba speaks very beautifully about it. He points out something remarkable. He says, you see that everywhere else where we have a mitzvah to remember something, on Purim, right? What do? We open a Megillah, we read it. You have to remember what Amalek did to you. What do? You open up a Sefer Torah and you read it. You need to remember something, you read it, you talk about it. Why is Leila Seder so different? Leila Seder is all these questions, right? We're trying to stir people to ask questions. Just talk about it. Just read some psukim.
You're not supposed to just read it. You're supposed to live it. We don't say it's like when I was a slave in Egypt. You say, I was a slave in Egypt.
And you know what, says Rav Volba? If you don't say that, you're a Rasha. Because the Rasha says, what's this avoda for you? And he excludes himself.
That's right.
And he says, you see that Pesach is all about what Hashem did for me. And as a matter of fact, we start to understand now, Avadim Hayinu B'Mitzrayim. We have all this Mishka Babel in time. We were slaves in Egypt. We weren't slaves in Egypt, right? We're slaves now. Why are we talking about what we are now? And this is the Chametz. It's like everything merges together, and it's like time is one big thing, and we're experiencing Mitzrayim right now. Because we are.
This is the matzah.
This is the matzah. That's right. That's right. We're experiencing Mitzrayim right now. What is Mitzrayim? Mitzrayim comes from the word Metzarim, right? Constraints, things that confine us. This was a society run by a paro. Paro comes from the word parua, to be exposed, to be visible. All their parnasa came from the Nile. They didn't have to look up for invisible rain. It was all right there, right? They were buried above the ground. You could see their images on the sarcophagus. Everything about Mitzrayim was, can I touch it? Can I feel it? It's about how physical can I be. Now, if you are going free from that, you have to truly be enslaved to it. You have to have a shiabud. So the Jewish people were deep in it. In order to get out of the shiabud, Hashem had to do something extraordinary. So the Maharal says in Gvuras Hashem, he points out that the miracle of the Exodus was just the fact that we ever left. He brings a Chazal. Chazal said that leaving Egypt was greater than all the miracles that ever happened to the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, when we talk about leaving Egypt, we have a mitzvah to recall leaving Egypt every day, right? According to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, every night as well. All we have to say is, I left Egypt. Because he says that itself is the greatest miracle possible, right? Chazal, I believe it's a Tanchuma, used the analogy of the Jews being like a Uber, like a fetus in the mother's womb. What's a fetus in the womb? A fetus in the womb has no separate existence. It doesn't have its own reality. It's just part of this greater body. We were so entrenched in the Egyptian mindset that we had to do something radical.
But isn't a fetus like, doesn't it become a person after 40 days?
No.
No?
No. It's still a fetus. If a person kills a baby, which is in utero, he does not get the death penalty until the head comes out, or the majority of the body. It's still a fetus. It does not have an independent life. It doesn't have an independent existence. So, Hashem did this amazing thing, which is he gave us the ability to totally annihilate the Yetzer Hara. All physical constraints for a week so that we could go free. So, that's what Pesach, right? When we want to understand Pesach, what it is, what's a matzah? It's the ability to totally annihilate the Yetzer Hara and reach for heights that you never thought you could reach before, right? And the Kabbalists call this concept Muchen de Gadlus, right? Big brains. That was the big brains of the... There you go. There are different times a year where we operate, when Muchen de Gadlus, Muchen de Katnus, we have big brains, we've got small brains. Meaning Hashem just gives it to us, or we got to do the work. And of course we see that eventually chametz comes back into our lives. After 7 days you eat chametz again. Which makes you wonder, well, if chametz is the Yetzer Hara and chametz is bad...
So we got 51 weeks with the Yetzer Hara and then 1 week without.
That's right. Question is why? So we see that matzah never goes on the Mizbeach. Right? It's a Mishnah in Menachos that all the Menachos are matzah other than two. Two types of Menachah are chametz. They don't ever go on the Mizbeach, by the way. Right? But there are two types which are chametz, and one of them are the two breads that we bring on Shavuos.
Those are the funny shaped ones that are kind
of... No, not them. Those are their cousins.
Oh, okay.
Those they eat on Shabbos. On Shavuos, we bring two beautiful fat loaves of white bread. Highly refined, delicious, good stuff. Not the stuff that bounces off the walls. So what do we see? Shavuos is the atzeret to Pesach, right? That's why we call it atzeret. We have 7 days of Pesach, and Shavuos is the end of that process. Now there's 49 days in the middle. Why? Because, as always, when Hashem wants to take you out of one shiabud, and He wants you to go free, He also wants you to really go free, which is, means you have to learn how to do it yourself. So for 1 week, Hashem says, I'm going to let you out totally free. You'll taste what it's like to have Mochen the Godless, to be without a Yetzer Hara. And now for 7 weeks you're going to learn how to use that Yetzer Hara to the point that on the 50th day it's Kadosh. You can actually use it as an offering. You can include the Yetzer Hara into how you serve Hashem. That happens on the 50th day. But first you have to know what life is like without it. So practically, what that means for us, right? It's all nice, right? Ideas, Hashkaf, it's interesting. Practically, what that means for us is as follows. That on Pesach, Chazal are telling us that there's this tremendous flow into the world that allows you to do, to live like a malach. You can do things with kfitz and dilug, avoiding process, growing in ways spiritually which you never had been able to before. But there's one condition. There's one thing that you have to do on Pesach to get it. Which is, you have to want it. You have to realize...
I thought you have to eat matzah.
Yes.
Sorry.
Why do you have to eat matzah? Right? Why do you have to... Why do we spend so much time asking questions and talking about where we were and where we're going? To give us the tremendous desire to want to get out of where we are, which is living in Mitzrayim, living with the Yetzer Hara, eating matzah in Mitzrayim, and get to being free men in the land of Israel, eating that matzah, the matzah of going in, right? That's the one thing. So practically speaking, something to think about as you're sitting and eating the Seder, that everything we're saying, the process we're going through, there are a lot of gedolim who used to take time to relive personal mitzrayims that they had gone through, especially in the previous generation, people who had to run across fields being fired at, and that moment of hitting the border, going from Gullus to Geula in an instant, right? That's the voda for us on Pesach, to realize that that possibility exists for us. And when we go there, the Neshem can give us a tremendous amount of shefa, of overflow, of having tremendous insights and spiritual growth on Pesach, and we can experience, or at least do our best, move to try to get to the level of living for a week without the Yetzer Hara.
So it's just a matter of remembering all the bad that happened in the past, but looking to the future for all the good that's about to come.
To say, even though I'm here in the muck right now, I don't have to live here. No, Hashem can take me out.
Yeah.
Right? That potential that I could go out tomorrow. Now.
It's great.